Okay, so we are studying a combination of books, actually, about Hezekiah right now. The principal books that we are studying about the kings of Israel, of course, right now is 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. We're studying about King Hezekiah particularly, and we studied some chapters in 2 Chronicles 29 and 30, and got into chapter 31 at the beginning and saw that that was moving forward in time to when the Assyrians came against Hezekiah under the Assyrian king Sennacherib. And so then to try to keep things chronological, we went back to 2 Kings 18, where we had left off previously. And so that's where we were last week in our study. We got to verse 13. We're looking at verse 13 in 2 Kings 18. That pinpointed the exact time, as we had read in 2 Chronicles chapter 31 and verse 1. It says, "Now when all this was finished," speaking about all those things from chapters 29 and 30, those things that had to do actually going back to 29 and 30. We looking at those things at the beginning of Hezekiah's reign. So it was after those things that we studied there that what he was talking about concerning the Assyrians under Sennacherib coming against Hezekiah when that took place. But it didn't pinpoint the time in his reign. So 2 Chronicles 29 and 30 were about that very beginning of his reign from day one. Well, now it's the 14th year of Hezekiah when Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, came up against all the fenced cities of Judah and took them. That's 2 Kings chapter 18 and verse 13. So some of the other events, particularly that with the fall of Samaria to the Assyrians, that is the northern kingdom of Israel, when Hoshea, the last king of the northern kingdom, fell, and the remaining tribes of Israel of that kingdom were taken away into captivity by the Assyrians. That had been recorded in chapter 17. We studied about that there. But he ties that into Hezekiah's reign here in 2 Kings chapter 18. And we saw that in verses 9 through 12. What took place between the fourth year of Hezekiah's reign down through the ninth year of his reign. So that was a dominant feature after Hezekiah had turned his people of Judah, worked so hard to bring them back to the Lord, and even had recovered a remnant of the ones from the northern kingdom that repented. The dominant feature of the early years of his reign was the Assyrians coming against his brethren, the northern kingdom of Israel, and fighting against it, besieging Samaria, and then the fall of it, and taking all of them into captivity, because that directly then relates to what happened next, which became the big test for King Hezekiah and all the people of Judah and Jerusalem, because after the Assyrians came through, conquered the northern kingdom, of course, they were also conquering the kingdoms that were neighbor to Israel. They were falling to the Assyrians. I mean, the Assyrian, including Egypt, that mighty power. And so the Assyrian Empire rose to be what it was. And it had already achieved great power, especially under Tiglath-Pileser that we've previously read about. He was the real conqueror of the Assyrians, but then this is continued under his successors. Shalmaneser was the one that besieged and conquered Samaria and the northern kingdom of Israel. Now we're Sennacherib is the ruler that is going to continue this and come against Judah. So we were looking at this last week and trying to get more of the big picture of what was going on to really appreciate and understand the tests that Hezekiah and his people were under at this time. I mean, here's this mighty empire that has conquered all of these other nations, including the northern kingdom of Israel. All of them have been taken away. And now the Assyrians come through Judah. And it tells us there in 2 Kings 18:13 that the Assyrians under Sennacherib came up against all the fenced cities of Judah and took them. So all the defensive cities, every stronghold and where they had their soldiers to defend their frontiers, all of that has fallen. So now when that has happened, then the Assyrians, they have flooded through the land of Judah, and now what city remains? I mean, it's Jerusalem, their capital, the city of David. And that's where Hezekiah is, and that's where the people of Judah are. And so they're holed up there in what is the last of their cities. They're the last holdout, literally. So the Assyrians have conquered everything that is of not just Judah, but all of the Israelites, except for this city. And with this kingdom being so powerful that all these other nations have fallen also, how bleak would this look to the people? How strong would the temptation be to believe, okay, I mean, there's no one can stand before this. There's no way in the world we, as this little remaining city of Jerusalem, are going to be able to resist and hold out and withstand against this mighty empire. And if this were being looked at strictly from a human standpoint, what would be the chances of Jerusalem standing alone against the Assyrian Empire? I mean, what kind of modern day equivalence could we put that into? You could almost imagine. It's generally agreed that America is still as the most powerful nation in the world, but some think of just some little city somewhere. And could one little city somewhere stand against the might of the entire United States or something? I mean, it's kind of hard to really put it into a modern conception of what was going on, but I think we can appreciate this. This is one of the great powers of the ancient world. And here's one little city holding out. And if we're not factoring in God, what chance would there be? I mean, Jerusalem would go down easily before the Assyrians. Now, of course, that would be the wrong way to look at it. Because the fact that Assyria was already what it was because of whom? That was already God's work. Assyria would not have been raised up without someone raising them up, and that was God who did that. And so God raised up the Assyrians. He's the one that made them this great power. He's the one that made all of these nations fall before them. This was all the work of God. God is the one that set up all of these rulers, so all of this was his work. So this is, if we ever have the idea that things are in this world are basically running on its own and people are doing things, and then occasionally God might decide to stop this from happening, or he might do something here or over there. I mean, but overall, that it's just running on its own. If that's the view or the perception that we have of how this universe is, or this world is being run, that is not at all according to what God teaches in the scriptures. So are we supposed to walk by faith or by sight? Now, if we're walking by sight, and of course that's a phrase in 2 Corinthians 1, and we walk by faith and not by sight, he says there. Well, that's what we Christians must be. All right, well, if we were to, and this world, of course, walks by sight because they don't have faith. And what does this world see of God's hand and his his direction of all the things that are going on. How many people in this world can see God appointing the rulers and establishing the ordinances in all of the nations and kingdoms of men? Right. But they don't see, not with physical eyes. I mean, you don't see God with the physical eyes, and don't see with the physical eyes what he's doing. All right. But that's walking by sight. Where does faith come from? Hearing God's word. So where do we learn about what's really happening that we can't see with our physical eyes? And you remember Elisha when he asked God to open the eyes of his servant when all those when the Syrians were searching for him, and what did God do? Opened his eyes, and what did he then see? All of those chariots of fire surrounding for as God's protection for them, but so was Syria just doing whatever it wanted to? No. And so God was what God was doing couldn't be seen with the physical eyes, but God was there. We have glimpses in the book of Daniel is one in particular that tells us in foretelling, and how many great battles in history are still studied and remembered, particularly between the Greeks and the Persians. I mean, even if you don't realize it, what's the real long race that they run in the Olympics? What's that called? It's called a marathon. Why is it called that? Where did that name come from? Well, it's an ancient Greek city. What is the distance of a marathon? Isn't it 26.2 miles? Why is that the distance? Well, that's the distance a messenger, one of those Syrian-Greek battles, and a messenger ran that distance to Marathon to deliver the Persians had arrived and ended up getting the message out. I think the legend is that basically when he ran that, then he, see the one that collapsed and died after delivering the message? I don't know. I need to brush up on that. But anyhow, he made that long run to Marathon, so that's where the distance came from, where the name came from. But that all had to do with one of those battles between the Persians and the Greeks, and there's Thermopylae. I mean, a lot of those famous battles from history. But this went on for a long time, the struggles between East and West, Persia and Greece. But there was the foretelling of that struggle and those battles in the book of Daniel. But then when God's describing it there in Daniel, we're told about Michael, the prince, the angel. He's an archangel. But Michael was in a struggle with God's angels. Was the devil involved in that? And was he trying to do something? And God had his angels arrayed and in that struggle to ensure the outcome that God was desiring. But the devil was fighting what God was doing. Of course, in futility, he failed. Do we see God's angels and how God is using his angels in these different situations in the affairs of this world and things? And I mean, that we have no clue about that as far as what we can see with our physical eyes, but we hear God's word, and God tells us that he's the one that has set up the rulers in the kingdoms of men, and that the powers that be are ordained of God, and that God works all things after the counsel of his own will. And we see the examples of these different things where God tells us he's involved in everything, and he's got his angels, he's using all of this. We can't see it, not with our physical eyes, but we can walk by faith We can see it with our spiritual eyes based on what we've heard from God's word and know that he's doing all of this. Well, this is what's going on here too. He raised up Assyria to be what it is. And God takes credit for all of these works and that he was the one directing that. And last week we looked at a couple of the prophecies in the book of Isaiah. And the book of Isaiah figures prominently in our study of these events involving the Assyrians and the things in Hezekiah's lifetime. And why is that the case? Well, when was Isaiah on this earth and serving as God's prophet? Well, not entirely. I mean, his work started before Hezekiah. I mean, back in the time of Ahaz, Hezekiah's father. But Isaiah's right there. He was there from before this and during this time with Hezekiah. That's why. I mean, we're going to read about Isaiah in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, and therefore we read about Hezekiah in the book of Isaiah. I mean, so this fits together. So before Hezekiah comes around, in the days of his predecessor, his wicked father Ahaz, and at the time when Pekah, the son of Remaliah, was on the throne of the northern kingdom of Israel before Hoshea became the last ruler, and when the reason was the king of Syria, we see prophecies that God inspired through Isaiah foretelling the coming of the Assyrians. And last week we looked at in chapter 7 at verses 17 through 20. And there God described the Assyrians as what in his hand? And what was he going to do with that? A razor. And what did God say he was going to do with that razor? The Assyrians being the razor. He was going to shave them slick. They were going to be shaved slick and bald with that razor. And they were going to be everywhere in the land, he said. So all the places where nothing was, they were going to be there. So he already foretold that he was going to bring the Assyrians against the people of Israel and Judah. And he was going to use them in that way. Then we also looked at chapter 8, verses 7 and 8. And there he used a different metaphor for the Assyrians, but again foretelling what they were going to do and exactly what we're reading about here at this point in our study in 2 Kings 18. He compared Assyria to what? A flood of waters. They were going to overflow their banks and they were going to come through the land and those waters were going to rise up how high? To the neck. Because what comes after that? If they get higher than there, what happens to you? Well, that's when you drown. It was going to come up as high as it could go before they were overwhelmed. So how bad was it going to be? I mean, it was going to be as bad as it could be without them being utterly destroyed. Now, if God was foretelling the utter destruction of Judah and Jerusalem and everything, he would have described that flood of waters not as rising up to the neck, but doing what? It would have overflowed and consumed them, but that's not what he said. He was going to shave them with the razor. He was going to shave them bald, and then he was going to bring them as a flood of waters right up to their neck. But then what was he going to do? So for them to be a razor, I mean, who was the one handling the razor, doing the shaving with the razor? I mean, were the Assyrians going to be the ones to shave them, or was it God going to be shaving them with the Assyrians? And who was the one that was going to make the flood of waters come up to their neck? So this was all God's work, and he was taking credit for it before it ever happened, telling them here's the way it was going to be. But at the same time, as he was warning them of this and telling them he was going to use the Assyrians in this way, he also was foretelling, and this is before Hezekiah becomes king, in the days of his father, when they were doing all of this wickedness, God was foretelling what he was going to do with the Assyrians, and but then that they ultimately were going to fail in what they were seeking to do, because they were going to go up to the neck, but that's as high as the waters were going to go. So as far as what the Assyrians intended to do, do they intend to be a flood through through Judah and up to the neck, or did they intend to be a flood to completely drown them all? They thought they would take Jerusalem too. Now that's exactly what we read in those words in Isaiah chapter 10. So we didn't get to this last week, but we want to now, as we're looking at these prophecies that all of this God said would happen, and he names the Assyrians over and over and over again. We can see why this is so prominent in the book of Isaiah, that God was foretelling this. Now, we don't want to think that that's all that Isaiah, for Isaiah, when he was prophet, this was what was in the very immediate future. In fact, it was in the immediate future when he began foretelling these things as he was inspired of the Lord and in the days of Ahaz and Pekah. But Isaiah lived through it, much like Jeremiah was used by God. I mean, these prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah, were these ones that, did they have a short career as a prophet of the Lord where they were around for one or two or three years and then that was that? Or were they around for decades? That's right. And this went on for many, many years. So in the case of Jeremiah, we find, he was a boy. When God first spoke to him, he was very young. When God first spoke to him, when he called him to be a prophet and told him he had actually appointed him for that from the womb, Jeremiah was quite young when God, much like we saw with Samuel, some of these prophets God spoke to in their youth for the first time. But then, like Samuel and like he did there with Jeremiah, we also see it with Isaiah. Some of these ones that God raised up to be prophets, God used them in his work for decades. And he did that with Jeremiah. So early when Jeremiah was younger, this is long past the Assyrians. Who gets most of the attention in the book of Jeremiah? Which empire? Babylon. Why? Because that's who the empire, they had succeeded the Assyrians, had supplanted them. They were the ones that were causing all the trouble for God's people in his time. And so in his younger years, he's foretelling of the Babylonians coming and the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple and all of those things that would happen. But not only did he foretell them in his younger years, but then, continued to live, continued to prophesy those things, and finally reached the point where those things were fulfilled and he lived through it. So he foretold it years before it happened, but then ended up living through the fulfillment of it. Well, that's what happens to Isaiah too. I mean, we can see in these chapters 7 and 8 and 10 and others that Isaiah foretells of the coming of the Assyrians. But who's in there in Jerusalem with Hezekiah now when these waters are up to the neck? Isaiah's in there with him. So Isaiah foretells it, but he also ends up living through the fulfillment of what God said, including the fulfillment of God's prophecies that Assyria would then be judged by the Lord and destroyed, and that Jerusalem would be saved, that God was going to save them. He was going to bring the Assyrians up to their neck, but then God was going to, that's where it would stop. And then God was going to defeat the Assyrians. So that was foretold also, and Isaiah got to live through that too. But the point is, these prophecies are there. And the prophecies of what the Assyrians were going to do came before Hezekiah was king. Isaiah continues to be used by God to speak in the ears of Hezekiah and his people through the time when these things are unfolding and happening. But question, did the coming of the Assyrians, did that come as a complete and utter shock to Hezekiah? Who are these guys? Where do they come from? What are they doing here? What, was it like that? Or did Hezekiah know, had he heard, and did he know this was coming? He knew it. He knew it, and then he saw it happening. I mean, he would have heard the words and known what Isaiah said. And he was a contemporary, and Isaiah was around him. He knew this. Well, then the Assyrians, I mean, they were causing great affliction that he saw as a boy growing up when his father was king, and Ahaz turned to the Assyrians to try to bail him out from the troubles he was having with Pekah, the king of Israel, who had allied with Rezin, the king of Syria. And so instead of turning to the Lord, Ahaz goes and buys off the Assyrians to try to get them to help. But was it to his help or to his hurt? Who ended up causing great trouble for Ahaz? The Assyrians. Well, who was the son of Ahaz that would have been around to see that? I mean, so Hezekiah was already seeing these things, seeing the wickedness of his father. Isaiah was sent directly to speak these things to Ahaz. That's what we saw in chapter 7. I mean, Hezekiah would have been very aware of all of this. He was a witness to these things. So he knew the Assyrians were coming. He'd been seeing the trouble they'd been causing. And now after he becomes king, he can see them. And there would have been this urgency, as we had seen when he became king, and then he was holding the Passover, and he was making that effort to try to encourage his brethren from the northern kingdom to repent, to come to that Passover, and to turn back to the Lord. I mean, with the understanding that Hezekiah had with what the Assyrians were doing and what was going to happen to that northern kingdom, as they had already taken almost half the tribes in Pekah's time. So they had already done that. I mean, Hezekiah knew all that, so he knew what was coming. There's a desperation or sense of urgency to it very much as Hezekiah is trying to get them to turn back to the Lord before it's too late. Well, then whammo, a few were saved, as we saw, but then the Assyrians conquered and took away all that was left. Does Hezekiah know, okay, now they're going to come, I'm next? He knows that. Isaiah has foretold it. Does he know that they're going to come flooding through the land up to the neck? He's been told this. The prophet that spoke those words in his father's days is with him. He knows they're coming, and now they've come. And so he's seeing all of this come to pass. Well, believing, having this mighty empire on their doorstep that was around all of his life, to know that there would be, to believe that there was going to be trouble from them, was that going to be a hard thing to be able to accept or believe? That would not have seemed to be very difficult to believe. Okay, look at these guys over here. They're going to cause more trouble. I mean, that would really not be a stretch to have to believe that. But now, seeing all that they've done, to believe what God is going to say, okay, but now trust in me. They're going to come up to your neck just before you drown, but you depend and you trust in me to deliver you, and I'll do it. That is a test of faith. Holding out as this one little city of Jerusalem against this mighty empire. And God says, don't try to turn to someone else to bail you out. Ahaz had done that. Don't, or many others in their history. Don't try to turn to men to save you. Don't try to turn to anything else. Turn to me. Trust me. Believe me. I'll save you. Is there a test to that? I mean, that's a strong test, to believe that God is going to, without you doing anything else, okay, I'm just going to rely on you, Lord, to save me out of this. And looking at it, here we are, this little tiny city and this mighty empire that's already conquered everything that we can see around us. Well, we need to remember this because I mean, we have lots of times in our life where different things, well, it was the Assyrians that were the flood up to their neck, but don't we all have our faith tested? And I mean, there are going to be waters that are going to be up to our neck from time to time. They won't be the Assyrians, but it'll be something else, other situations, other problems. And we're going to be tested in that. And if we look at, okay, how are we going to get out of this? How are we going to get through this? And we might not see the way out, but do we then turn to try to do things our own way or follow what men say to do or how to get out of this or what we should do? Or are we going to believe God and trust the Lord and do things His way all the way through it, no matter what it is that we're going through? So this has very practical implications for all of us. That's what we're studying it for, to learn from as examples. This is supposed to encourage us in the running of our own race. Because who is the one that's really bringing this temptation against Hezekiah? The temptation is going to be trust yourselves or trust somebody else other than God. Don't believe. There's no way He's going to be able to get you out of this. You better fend for yourselves or do this. There's going to be the devil tempting them. That's going to be coming from the devil. And it's God who's going to be providing the salvation there, as He always does. So it's the same devil that's trying to tempt us to trust anybody or anything else other than God. And it's God that's encouraging us to rely on Him, trust in Him, and have our faith in Him through everything. So the situation's identical in those terms if we understand who's behind all of it. And we have the same God to trust in that's on our side that was on Hezekiah's. So this should be very encouraging for us to see this and what ends up happening. But in Isaiah chapter 10, the Lord was foretelling here in this chapter, as He had started to do in chapters 7 and 8, but what the Assyrians were going to do, and even records the words that the Assyrians used and what their concept of things were going to be. Well, let's read first verses 5 through 11, which is going to match up precisely with what God said in chapter 7 as He was going to use these Assyrians as a razor in His hand to shave them, or in chapter 8, the flood of waters that was going to come upon them and rise up to their neck. So in verse 5 here in Isaiah 10, He says, "O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger and the staff in their hand is mine indignation." So who is immediately taking credit here for what the Assyrians were going to be doing? Yeah. The Assyrians, from God's perspective, the words He uses in verse 5, what were they to God? A rod or a staff, a stick in His hand. His hand. Whose anger was it? It was God's, and God's picking the Assyrians up. God's raised them up. Now He's created them to be a tool in His hand to punish His people for all the wickedness. And we've already been reading about this for quite a while. I mean, we know how wicked the northern kingdom was, those tribes there, and they had been persisting in that for so long, the entirety of their existence as a separate kingdom, as we said, for 208 years. As it turned out in actual time, but 208 years of wickedness and rebellion for those tribes. And then you had Judah with all the wickedness that they fell into, and especially what they sunk to under Ahaz, Hezekiah's father. Did God have reason to have this indignation that He's speaking of here? He had great reason for it, and now He was going to use the Assyrians as the rod in His hand to mete out His punishment for all of this. So in verse 6, He says, "I will send him against a hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey and to tread them down like the mire of the streets." Now, is He talking about what we were reading about in 2 Kings 17 and in verses 9 through 12 of chapter 18, when the Assyrians came and destroyed the northern kingdom of Israel and took all of them into captivity. Now, God had used them as a rod in his hand to do that too, but is that what he's taught? Is that what he's foretelling here in this chapter? Or has that already happened? Well, it's happened or is happening or about to happen, but that's not the focus of chapter 10. Now, interesting, I'm going to mention this as an aside. We get to chapter 14, we have a prophecy of what was going to happen to the king of Babylon. And it's actually Belshazzar, the one we read about in Daniel 5. So I just mention that because when we're reading through these chapters, Isaiah did not only foretell about the Assyrians that were in his immediate future, but he also foretold, God used him to foretell of what was going to be coming more than 100 years into the future after them, what the Babylonians were going to do. And that's one of the things that makes the book of Isaiah, in some ways, even more challenging or difficult at times than, like Jeremiah or Ezekiel. Because we don't have to sort out you got the Assyrians and the Babylonians. The Assyrians are long gone by the time you get to those other books. But Isaiah, we got all of that there. So we get to read about things the Assyrians were going to do. We get to read about things the Babylonians were going to do. So we have to try to keep all that straight. But I'm just mentioning that for you just to keep in your minds for when you're studying the other chapters here. Because it's just, four chapters from now, he's going to have that one about the king of Babylon. And it's the same principle, though, he's going to apply there. But while we're here on the Assyrians, he's not talking here about what he was going to do to Samaria. This is specifically what he was going to be doing to Judah and the threat against Jerusalem, the southern kingdom. And I'm not making that up. Let's read further. That hypocritical nation and the people of his wrath that he's talking about right here, the people of Judah. So he was going to come against them to take the spoil, to take the prey, to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Well, when he says they came against Judah and against all their fenced cities and took them, does that fulfill that? They don't have any whiskers left, do they? And the waters have come up to the neck. I mean, this is fulfilling all of those things that we've been seeing in these chapters that Isaiah has been prophesying about. Verse 7 says, "Howbeit he meaneth not so." What does that mean? "Neither doth his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and cut off nations, not a few." So here's God saying, here's what they're going to do. And he's going to go on to speak about the limits that are there. But is there any limit in the Assyrians' minds about what they're going to do? No, they're going to keep on shaving. They're going to keep on flooding. I mean, that's what they're thinking in their minds. So here's the words of their king. "For he saith, are not my princes altogether kings? Is not Calno as Carchemish? Is not Hamath as Arpad? Is not Samaria as Damascus?" Has Samaria fallen at this point? Just like Damascus had done. Remember when we read about Rezin being killed, when the Assyrians conquered Syria and Damascus, killed their king? Well, Damascus is a has-been now for the Assyrians, but so is Samaria. Samaria's already fallen in the words of the king here. Now, does this necessarily mean when God is saying, here's what the king of Assyria is saying, that that's already happened in actual time? This could still be in Ahaz's time. It certainly seems to fit as one body of prophecy there. I obviously cannot precisely state that one way or the other, but just to mention, I mean, when he's recording the words that we're going to, as if this has already occurred, well, maybe it has, But when God says, here's what's going to happen and here's what he's going to say, and speaking of the certainty of it in this manner, we've got plenty of examples where he's done that before the events actually ended up transpiring or the prophecies being fulfilled. So whether God is just foretelling this or whether this is after the fact doesn't change the point that God was the one that was doing all of this, knew the heart of these Assyrians, and this is what their king was thinking and what he was going to be expressing. Is not Samaria as Damascus? As my hand hath found the kingdoms of the idols and whose graven images did excel them of Jerusalem and of Samaria, shall I not, as I have done unto Samaria and her idols, so do to Jerusalem and her idols? So in the mind of the king of Assyria, what is Jerusalem compared to Samaria? No difference. And were there idols in Samaria? Well, that's the reason why God was shaving them. That's why he had that indignation and wrath he was speaking about. All of that idolatry and wickedness that they were engaged in. They were filled with idols. Well, Jerusalem had been too, and that's why even though under Hezekiah we've seen repentance come, yet this punishment is still being brought in this case. Now it's going to be a test. Is their repentance genuine? Are they really going to trust the Lord? When there were no Assyrians around and they had a wonderful Passover that they extended an extra week and then go out there to tear down all these high places where their idols have been, that's one thing. But now with the Assyrians having conquered their entire land and their hold up here in Jerusalem, what do they have to look forward to? Well, if the test is going to be, well, look what did happen to Samaria. The Assyrians camped there and besieged the city for 3 years. What happens in a three-year siege if you're in a city like that? Why did they engage in sieges? Well, they want to fight an unnecessary battle and risk the lives of their own soldiers, so they just surround it and then wait. And what happens when a city like that was surrounded? Starve them out. I mean, how's food going to, in a city, how's food going to come in if it's surrounded by the enemy? There's no way to get food in there. So that, yeah, are they going to have some stores in the city? Well, yeah, but what's going to happen over the course of years, however long it takes, maybe 3 years? Well, that's going to run out. The food's going to run out. People are going to be starving. What else is going to be running rampant? Disease. So people are going to be dying of starvation, disease, and there's not going to be any army to fight. There's not going to be a battle then. They just let them besiege them, let them fall victim to starvation, disease, and then they just walk in. It's theirs. That's what happened to Samaria. So now they've come against Jerusalem, and if they don't trust the Lord, what are they thinking? What's their future going to be looking like here for the next while, however long that takes? They get to look forward to several years now of rationing and slow starvation and disease coming. I mean, all of this. This would be a very, very bleak picture. And that's what the Assyrians have in mind. And Jerusalem's not going to be any different. And are Jerusalem's idols going to be able to save that city any more than the idols of Samaria had been able to save Samaria? That's their perspective. What were they not factoring in? Or who were they not factoring in? Much like Nebuchadnezzar, we can read about later. You remember Daniel 4, and he's after... he's done all of this, and he's walking around in his palace thinking about how great he is. Look at what I've done. Look at what all I've got. And he's ticking off all the battles he's won and the nations that he's conquered as he's puffing himself up more and more and more. have not I done this? I did this. All of this, I. You can read in Daniel 4, all the I's and me's and everything in there. He wasn't giving God credit for being the one who raised him up, who gave him all these things, and God had promised through Daniel that he was going to remove him from his kingdom until he learned that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. And it was at that moment when he was with his inflated ego as he's walking around thinking about how wonderful he was and great and mighty he was, that's the moment that God fulfilled that, and then he learned. But he had to learn that. Well, what's the Assyrian, what's he thinking here? How many of the conquerors don't think they've done it all themselves and think they're great? How many of those great conquerors end up having the great attached to their names? Do they encourage that or discourage that? Do you think Alexander the Great thought he was great? yeah. And, I mean, but look at all that he did. You know how old he was when he died? Alexander. Did he die in a ripe old age? He was 33. He was 33 when he died. I mean, it is astounding not to think what he did, but what God did with him in such a short period of time that he conquered it all. And the legend is that he wept when he finally got to India, and that he allegedly wept because there was nobody else to conquer. He got introduced to some of the problems in India, and they got very sick. It was right after that he ended up making his way back to the area of Babylon, which is where he died. But there's thinking that he may have India may have been what got him. But anyhow, that's not hard to believe if you've been there. But he was 33 when he died. Alexander the Great, did he think he was great? But it was God who was great that did all that. He just happened to use him, but he took him out at 33. That's not too great. How come he couldn't make himself to live to be 34 or to be an old man to enjoy all of that? He wasn't so great. But anyway, we can see what the Assyrian was thinking. Verse 12, though, here's what God said. And this is a promise from God, and Hezekiah is going to know this promise. Does he believe it? So it's not that when we read about how much Hezekiah trusted the Lord, it's not because Hezekiah was called upon to believe something, take some leap in the dark. That's not what faith is. Faith comes by hearing God's word. It's based in the evidence of what God has said, and we know who our God is. And so did Hezekiah, but he had these words of promise right here. Verse 12, God said, "Wherefore it shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. For he saith, by the strength of my hand have I done it, and by my wisdom, for I am prudent, and I have removed the bounds of the people and have robbed their treasures, and I have put down the inhabitants like a valiant man, and my hand hath found a net as a nest, the riches of the people, and as one gathereth eggs that are left, have I gathered all the earth, and there was none that moved the wing or opened the mouth or peeped." I mean, that's how he's thinking and speaking, the king of Assyria. Oh, look at the pride there. Look at what I've done. Verse 15, "Shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith, or shall the saw magnify itself against him that shaketh it, as if the rod should shake itself against them that lift it up, or as if the staff should lift up itself, as if it were no wood? Therefore shall the Lord of hosts, send among his fat ones leanness, and under his glory he shall kindle a burning like the burning of a fire, and the light of Israel shall be for a fire, and his holy one for a flame, and it shall burn and devour his thorns and his briars in one day, and shall consume the glory of his forest and of his fruitful field, both soul and body, and they shall be as when a standard bearer fainteth. And the rest of the trees of his forest shall be few, that a child may write them. And it shall come to pass in that day that the remnant of Israel and such as are escaped of the house of Jacob shall no more again stay upon him that smote them, but shall stay upon the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. The remnant shall return, even the remnant of Jacob, unto the mighty God. So that's what God foretold. What was he going to do with the Assyrians after all of this? He was going to punish Judah with them and Jerusalem, and he was going to put them to the test, but then he said, my people will trust on me, and then I'm going to destroy these Assyrians. So did Hezekiah have that promise? The question is he going to believe it? And yes, he's going to believe what God said. That's the point. He hears what God says, and he's going to believe it, and he is going to trust in the Lord for his deliverance, and God's going to fulfill his promise just as he said. So we'll get to that more, Lord willing, next week. Let's close in prayer.